welcome to episode number 142 of The Big Web Show, everything web that matters. I'm your host, Jeffrey Zeltman. Today's Big Web Show guest is Abby Covert, information architect, founder and curator of IA Summit, president of IA Institute, teacher in the Products of Design MFA program at New York's School of Visual Arts, and author of the book I hold in my left hand right now, How to Make Sense of Any Mess, a brilliant book of information architecture. Abby, hello.
Hi, Jeffrey. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for making time today. The term IA, let's just get this out of the way. The term IA seems to have fallen out of favor lately. It's not as quaint as webmaster, but for some people, it's almost as antiquated. Do those folks have the wrong idea?
I think they do. I think that if anything, information architecture is becoming even more important in this increasing world of complexity and cross-channel communications.
How so?
Well, it feels like language and structure have always been a part of what we do from a human standpoint, right? Like from the dawn of thought, we've been trying to figure out how to clearly communicate with one another. And the term information architecture was coined, you know, sometime in the 70s in the design and technology community. But really, if you think about it, it's a retronym. It's describing something that's always existed and been part of the way that we think about structure and language of getting our message across. So when the web came about and we started to use information architect as a job title, it was really to fill this, you know, kind of fundamental need of figuring out how are we going to make sense of this new kind of place that we're developing in the digital world. And I don't think anybody would argue with the fact that that digital world has gotten more complicated and more complex to talk about, to think about, to work on, and to, you know, talk to other people outside of the design and technology community about. So information architecture, I think, is a common human skill set, and it's something that more people would be benefited from understanding at a deeper level.
It's funny, you know, you've been doing this for 10, 15 years?
Yeah, 13 years.
13 years. So there was a time when it was a purely underground activity, right? When putting stuff on the web was a purely underground activity, and it was kind of an expert activity.
Yep.
Right? Information architecture was the thing that made it possible, in my opinion, for it to become the mass activity it is now, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, now PBS will have an article for parents on, are they putting too many pictures of their kids on Facebook? Is that good for the kids? That was an inconceivable state of things. It was inconceivable to imagine the web being, and the internet being, as just, you know, just distributed and used in so many ways and so much a part of life.
Absolutely.
As it is now.
Yeah, no, we've really adopted this web thing as a new place. I mean, it's the new third place in all of our lives. And it doesn't matter what you do or what your technical savvy is. There's this moment where you realize that you can put content onto the web and you don't need to have special tools or skill sets to do so. But the question still exists of are you clearly communicating to other people by the ways that you're putting that stuff up there?
Now, is IA a job title for most people, or is it just part of the job for designers? What's your feeling on that?
I think that IA is something that is not just practiced by specialists, but there are times when specialists need to be involved. And I think that it all really depends on the size of the project. You know, I've worked on a lot of projects as an IA specialist, and the projects that I tend to be brought onto are the ones that have a mass of complexity that people who don't have IA as a specialty are not prepared to deal with. So I get called in when there's, you know, thousands of things to organize as opposed to tens or hundreds of things.
Are you talking about complexity of possible interactivity, or are you talking about complexity of, you know, 15, 20 years of content that's all over the place?
It could be either one. I mean, two projects that I've done in the last year are kind of good examples of the ends of the spectrum. The first project I did this year was for a company that is a small startup, and they just acquired two other startups. And through going through the process of kind of reconciling what does that mean, they realized that they were operating in three different languages. And I don't mean like English, Spanish, and French. I mean like they all had different words for different things that were needing to be reconciled and brought together. So that's a kind of an increasing interactivity.
That's our whole industry. I mean, that's
exactly.
In fact, that's one of the things we're talking about today, right?
Mm-hmm.
Is this activity of design, is it information architecture? Is it design? Why is it UX? People have different names for different parts of it, or?
Right. It's kind of an information architecture problem, right?
It is an information architecture problem.
We have this like labeling and taxonomic issue with not being able to describe ourselves very well, which I think indicates the need for information architecture, if anything, because it's saying that those conversations, they make people get really fired up. That means that it's important, you know, like the way we classify ourselves, the way we talk about ourselves, the way we sell our work.
But that people all do resent. Clarity. They resent when, and you must have this problem too as a consultant, people resent when someone else names stuff. When if I'm a designer and you come in and say, no, that's really information architecture, what you're doing. There's always the chance that I'll go, no, it's not. It's design. That's a fine word for me. And, you know, have a nice day.
Right. And that's actually why I've started to really police myself on the way that I think about information architecture. I tend to not use it as a pronoun, if possible. So it's a skill. It's something that teachers do and policymakers do and project managers do and designers do and content strategists do. So, you know, the fact that I happen to specialize in just doing that doesn't mean that those other people aren't doing that from not specializing in it.
Right. And you were going to talk about the two poles, and I think we cut you off somehow, which mean I cut you off. But you were talking about two different projects. So one was making sense of the different vocabularies that these three startup businesses used to describe many of the same things.
Yep. And they, just for sheer example sake, they had 14 words for the same core object that was the center of their business. So 14 different ways to say it, which, you know, when you have an agile organization creating language all day long, that tends to happen. It's sort of like barnacles.
Well, it's the same reason that we need that in design, more and more people are making style guides and like multi-level style guides on every possible component of a project. Because if you have 10 designers working on something, guess what? You're going to have 20 different button styles, 30 different button styles. And
exactly.
And then the user's trying to make sense of it going, is this a button? I thought they were red, but they're blue here.
Yeah. So the other project that I work on, I worked on this last year was for a very large corporation that has over 28 million pages of content that they're trying to reconcile. And it has amassed over a 20-year period. So when you look at something like that, you know, the act of organizing it isn't actually the hard part. The act of organizing it is the easier part. The hard part is getting people to not be afraid of it and to actually dive in and to break it up into small enough workable areas that it can be worked on over time. So a lot of my job on projects like that is sort of like information therapist. Like I'm getting them to be okay with the mess that's in front of them and then giving them actionable steps towards making sense of it.
My IA friends who call themselves content strategists often, you know, Karen McGrain, Christina Halverson often talk about themselves in exactly the same way as therapists, making it okay to have these conversations.
Yep. No, and both of those women that you just mentioned are heroes of mine. So I appreciate that they're saying the same things.
Do you find that do you ever have to portray yourself as a content strategist to get some, like, would it be easier if you have a million pieces of content to call yourself a content strategist in organizing it, or to say my associate in my consultancy who's a content strategist is going to lead this part?
Right. So I work with content strategists pretty often, usually on the client side, as opposed to within an agency structure or a consultancy, because I work on my own. So I'm sort of a gun for hire. But I think that the best way for me to describe the difference between information architecture and content strategy is that IA is like building the vehicle. It's deciding how things are going to be arranged and structured and labeled. Content strategy is putting gas in the vehicle and making sure that it's not going to run out of gas over time. So it's figuring out the governance structures and the creation of content process and the publishing implications across channels for making that information architecture come to life. So I can't do a project without content strategy being involved, but often I'm sharing that responsibility with other people.
It is absolutely brilliant. I love the way you describe things. Thank you for coming on the show.
You're welcome.
It makes me feel smarter just listening to you. When you talk about overcoming people's fear, I remember a story years ago when I was getting sober. There was a story about an alcoholic woman who was becoming sober, and one day she realized that she was a hoarder and that all the time she'd been drinking, her apartment was filled with old newspapers, pizza boxes, every piece of detritus imaginable. And she was, of course, filled with shame, but also she felt helpless, like there was nothing she could do. It seemed like too overwhelming a job. And this wasn't a rich person. She couldn't just hire someone to fix it for her. So she talked to her sponsor, and the sponsor said, just pick up the gum wrappers today.
Yep.
And then, after about a few days, it was like, let's just maybe pick up a pizza box. So just always pick up something, right? And eventually she cleaned her apartment. And it's a metaphor for how people get sober, because usually when people get sober, their lives are total wreckage, right? Their marriage, their kids, whatever. It's just awful. And it's overwhelming, the shame and fear. But if you just approach things gradually, a piece at a time, it works. Do you use that kind of approach? Like, let's just take this little step by step. How do you?
Absolutely. My teaching practice at the School of Visual Arts, my chair and I have a joke that my class is somewhere between a Girl Scout meeting and an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting.
Ah.
Because it really is about the overcoming the anxiety. And I mean, I say things like, admitting it is the first step.
Yeah.
Because in a lot of cases, that really is the part that I can help the most with, especially in organizations that are large and segmented and siloed, is just getting them to admit that they have a problem at all. Because we're not incentivized to point out problems in the workforce. Like, we're incentivized to provide solutions.
Right.
And solutions, and inevitably have to be connected to a problem, but we sort of like don't like to admit how bad things are at some points.
Even if things aren't really bad, even if there are just some institutional problems, a lot of people don't want to hear it.
Yeah. And a lot of people hide those things from executives. Like, I get the comment as an outsider coming in, I generally will get the reaction from somebody after, a workshop on information architecture in a company, they'll say something like, well, I've known that this is a problem for years. And my answer to them is always like, did you say anything to anybody? And they're like, well, yeah, like at the water cooler at lunch, I'm like, oh, why do they call it that? We call it this, we call it that. But the idea of raising the flag all the way to the top and saying, hey, we have a problem here, it just isn't something that many people are incentivized to do.
People are punished for it.
Exactly.
I worked before I was I worked for other people for a long time, and nobody likes the person who points out problems, right? Nobody likes
right.
that. And also you get exhausted if you keep bringing it up in the most tactful way possible. One of the reasons people hire consultants is so they can tell the boss the same things that the employees have been telling the boss for 5 years.
Yep.
Right. I once had, Carl Malamud, he's a really longtime internet personality. He and his ex organized the Internet World's Fair in like 1996. But anyway, I was once asking him, like, why do people pay Jacob Nielsen $25,000 for a day? I don't understand that. This was years ago. I was asking him that. I don't know if that's his rate now. And he said, I would pay that in a heartbeat. I said, why? He said, because if he could get my board of directors to do what I've been trying to tell them to do, it's worth $25,000. And it made me understand capitalism a little better. Mm-hmm. And that, what's real money to people isn't real money to businesses. But it also made me understand the value a consultant brings, which is they're like magically endowed with permission because they're outside the structure. So they're allowed to come in almost like a therapist can come in and tell a family something it doesn't want to hear. Again, to go back to therapy, right? If mom says something or dad says something or the kids say something, everyone gets bent out of shape. They don't have permission to tell the truth. So some outsider comes in and has permission.
Yeah. No, I think it also highlights that agreement is this requirement that we all have for the work that we do, but getting agreement is such a process, and it can sometimes be a more difficult process than even the implementation part.
Well, the W3C, the history of web standards, is you know, it's history of agreement. My friend Jeremy Keith says the web is agreement. And yeah, he's right. But getting to those agreements is murder. And when you finally get to them, guess what? New people come in who don't agree.
Right. Or the world completely changes and you have to consider everything from another channel's perspective, like mobile or social media or all these other things we've been thrust into.
Exactly. Now, one of the things you did, you were talking about, you know, facing your fears and all that. That stuff is in your book. And one of the things I love about your book is it's very well designed in the sense that you've done all the work. It's very easy to understand, which means all the really hard conceptual stuff you took care of so the user doesn't have to see it. The reader doesn't have to see it. Right? Kind of like what an IA does. Right.
Yeah, it was the most meta IA assignment that I've ever given myself, for sure.
Yeah.
You really have to eat your own dog food if you're writing a book about IA. It's like, the IA, that thing better be pretty dang clear.
Yeah, right? Because I remember when I was in college and graduate school, I thought if a film didn't seem to make any sense or a piece of art was hard to understand, then it must be good. And if a book was really... they had lots of words in it that I didn't understand, it must be good. And if something was simple and anyone could understand it, there was something flawed about it. And actually, my writing was ruined for a few years after school. It took me a while to realize, like, that communication was actually a better thing than trying to pretend to be some kind of elite, I don't know what, T.S. Eliot or whatever. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, totally.
But that's what we do. That's what design is. Right? That's what IA is. All these things are, there's this fantastic amount of complexity, and if people really knew about it, they'd throw up.
Yeah. And, absolutely.
And even, like, if you go to a bank website and it's terrible, and you're like, man, they're showing me so much complexity. Probably not. They're probably already really good IAs who have worked on that stuff to hide 9/10 of it.
Yeah.
The remaining 10% they're showing you still sucks and is still too complex, and there's still a lot more work that could be done. And usually that's because of software, right?
Oh, gosh, software. So it's just so hard. Like, the web is just – it's still so complicated to build anything.
How do you – right, in a way, old software is your enemy, right? If you're about designing a clean, simple experience that hides all the complexity from the user – and makes them feel empowered and makes them feel smart and like they just know what to do next. That's your job. But how do you do that when the client comes to you with this legacy system or mm-hmm. legacy institution too? It's not just software.
Right.
Right.
Yeah.
50 people have to sign off on this. And, you know, no matter how many times we come to this very clear, simple idea of what it is we're trying to communicate, it's going to get watered down and compromised into nonsense. How do you deal with that on a daily basis?
Well, I try not to get too attached to my final ideas. I try to not have ideas very often at all as an IA. Because I'm dealing with people having ideas all day long. That's sort of that's the mess that's being brought to me. It's like, this person's got an idea and this person's got an idea and this person had an idea and they got so fired up about it, they went and built it on a totally different system and now it has to get reconciled. So I talk about my work as, I like the metaphor of I'm like the coffee filter. And my clients' ideas are like the grounds. And my job is to help them to remove the grit and to make it something that's drinkable. And that takes a lot of not having opinions and not having ideas of my own. And of course, I have ideas. Like, you can't keep yourself from having them. But I try not to share them. And I think that that's it's something that people react interestingly to, especially as an outsider, because they expect, especially with the word consultant, they expect me to come in slinging ideas around, you know, kind of the selling ideas as a business.
As a huckster.
Exactly. But that's not what I do. I just refuse to have ideas be mine. Like, I'll help you to sort through yours and I'll help you to map out the implications of what that idea means for your organization. I'll tell you if users think that that's a bad idea or that it's flawed in some way based on research, but I won't give you ideas. That's just not my job. I work with smart people that do that all day. So why be one more?
Brilliant. We're going to take a quick sponsor thank you break. Today's Big Web Show is brought to you by A List Apart for people who make websites. Since 1998, A List Apart has explored the design, development, and meaning of web content with a special focus on web standards and best practices. From a DAO of web design to the end of table layouts, from lists for navigation to working with alternative style sheets, from accessibility to readability, and from the holy grail of CSS layout to sliding doors to responsive web design, A List Apart has long been a leading voice of web design and development. And it's your voice, the voice of this community. Stay in the game and ahead of the curve at alistapart.com. That's alistapart.com for people who make websites. That went down easy. I like that sponsor.
I love that sponsor.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah.
You need to write for us, but you have been busy writing this book on Amazon. Your book is frequently bought together with Don't Make Me Think and The Design of Everyday Things, the two classics of usable design. How does that feel?
Oh my gosh. I'll be totally honest with you. I took a screenshot of it the other day and sent it to my mom.
Does your mom, is your mom going to go, oh my God, Steve Krug, Don Norman?
Yeah, totally. I'm nerdy enough that my mom knows who those people are.
She does.
Yeah.
Okay.
She does.
has either of those authors read your book or talked to you about it at all?
Steve Krug has talked to me about it. And he was, he had nice things to say. So that was great.
I haven't
heard from Don Norman, but I would love to.
Okay. Well, I don't think he listens to this show, but if he does, Peter Morville, though, is a fan of yours. He's the co-father of information architecture for the web. Co-father is kind of a weird word. I don't know. Co-author of Information Architecture for the World Wide Web with Lewis Rosenfeld, the book that really started the discipline as it pertains to the web. He called your book a brilliant introduction to information architecture. It's short and easy to read, but covers all the bases. And again, easy to read almost sounds like a put down and would be in some cases, but here it's the highest compliment because easy to use, easy to read, easy to understand. That's what design's about. That's what IA is about.
Yeah. I mean, I think that it's interesting because one of the things I talk to my students about is that you have to choose a direction. And by choosing a direction, you are, in fact, walking away from something else that you could have gone towards.
Right.
And so, you know, if you, all of my good reviews on Amazon are wonderful and they make me feel warm and fuzzy and like I did my job. But if you read the bad ones, you'll see the direction I walked away from. You know, people will write a review that's like, I wish that it went deeper, or I wish it had gotten into more of the complexities of practicing it. And, you know, for that, I just have to say, that's not the book I chose to write. Like,
right.
The book I chose to write was at a sixth grade reading level, and it was meant to serve as a controlled vocabulary for practicing information architecture and understanding it from a beginner standpoint and also from an outside standpoint, that you didn't need to be a designer or a technologist to get it.
That's an interesting emotional reaction to the simplicity. That is someone who doesn't get what you do. My daughter, I'm looking at your choose a direction chart right now, and it's got like words we say, words we don't say. And I can see someone going, that's childish. Mm-hmm. But it's not. It's just simple. But my daughter, she's in fifth grade and has the same reaction to when the teachers are being very explanatory. She feels they're condescending, that mm-hmm. they're talking down to her and that it's boring.
Yeah.
So that's just that is a challenge. And no book can – you're walking away from it. No book's going to please everybody. Nothing can please everybody.
Exactly. My husband likes to say some people hate the Beatles.
Yes. Know? I had to include code in designing with web standards because otherwise it wouldn't have been effective. But honestly, for me, the first four chapters of the book were what I wanted to say. Mm. I had to include code because people needed to know how to do the thing, but that was the less interesting part. To me, the tactical and strategic arguments were the interesting part. But I had people who didn't like my book because it wasn't enough code, or said, you know, it's fine when he finally gets to the code, but this guy, he spends four chapters blabbing before he gets to the code. And I'm like, okay, I get it. You're already on board. You don't need this book. You need a code book. You need a thick book from like O'Reilly.
Yeah.
You need an 800-page book of code, and that's great. And there are people who write those. That's not what I do, and that's not what I did, and that's okay.
Right.
I'm, you know, we all have to be happy with our choices and know that they're not going to please everybody.
Yeah, I'm having my students this semester, spoiler alert if any of them are listening, but in a couple weeks' time, I'm giving the assignment for them to write their Amazon one-star reviews.
Of what?
Anything? Of their work, of their thesis
work. Of their own work.
Yeah. Because in last year, I had them write a blog post from somebody that they really respect dissing their work. Basically, like, what could that person come up with that would be a total put down based on what you've decided to do? And it was a really cathartic experience for them. You know, they were like, that was hard. Like, even the fact that I wrote it, but it was in their voice, and reading that from their voice, even though I knew exactly where the words came from, which was me, it was still really hard. But they have to be ready for that, even if it doesn't happen.
Did you invent that assignment?
You know, I don't know where my assignment ideas come from most of the time, but I found that one to be really interesting. I do weird things with them. I make them do elevator pitches and elevators and things like that. So
that is so much fun. Well, since we're dancing around it, what is the POD program, P-O-D program,
products of design. Yeah.
Products of design at School of Visual Arts in New York. What is that?
It's a brilliant program. We are getting ready to graduate our third class. So, you know, we're a fairly new program, all adjunct faculty. So it's all people that are top of their field in terms of what they do. And
right. The
idea is that rather than teaching these students to be attached to any one particular medium, they're going to dabble in all of the different mediums that kind of encapsulate design. I mean, down to they learn how to cook and to sew and to use Arduino and Raspberry Pi and 3D printing. And they take interaction design with students from Liz Danzigo's program. And there's all these kind of overlaps, but by the second year of the program, we ask them to determine what their thesis dissertation is going to be on, and then the second year of classes are using all those various mediums to realize work according to one theme or prompt for their thesis work.
You had me at Arduino.
I'm so jealous of my students. I keep telling Alan, my chair of that program, I'm like, would it be weird for me to come back as a student? Because it's just so cool. Like, they get to learn so much.
But you learn. I mean, I'm also, I teach at MFA in Liz Danzico's program for interaction design. I'm teaching tonight. It'll be my second class of the semester. My first class, we sat and discussed the worst job we'd ever had, which was great.
That's
and
awesome.
Cathartic. And, you know. And I'll tell you the worst job anyone had. There was a gentleman from South America who had to take care of babies at an orphanage.
Oh, gosh.
And babies and toddlers and young children, and nobody wanted them. And he had no training, but he became, you know, he changed them and fed them and everything else. And at the end of his It was supposed to be an internship. At the end of the internship, they said, no one's ready to replace you. Can you do another term? So he basically spent like 6 months with the kids.
Wow.
And then they said, you have to leave. You have to leave the kids now because they'll get too attached to you.
Oh, goodness.
And he said, but they're my kids. I don't understand. How can I? And he said, what's going to happen to them? Well, we can't tell you that. You have to leave because, you know, they're going to think you're their parent. But he had all these loving feelings toward these children. And then he had to, after 6 months, he had to be another person walking out of their life for reasons they didn't understand.
That's heartbreaking.
Yeah. That was kind of the worst thing I ever heard.
I feel a lot of sympathy for the student that had to go after that one. It's like you're going around in a table and yeah. like somebody tells that story
yeah.
and it's your turn. It's like, well,
yeah.
one time I cleaned up vomit in a nightclub
because yeah.
that would be my worst job be cleaning up vomit and other bodily functions in a nightclub.
How much, what did you do in the nightclub?
I was the lighting technician at the Middle East in Boston.
Okay. I don't.
It's a music club venue. It has three different areas for performances, and the largest of which has a professional lighting setup. And so I was the lighting technician. I was in charge of running the light show for rock bands.
Were you, what did you study?
Graphic design.
And how did you become a lighting tech?
I was in an intro to film class, and the guy who sat next to me in class had that job, and the person who worked the shifts opposite him that he couldn't pick up had quit. And so he was like, "Are you looking for a job? You could be a lighting technician." And I was like, "Sure. Sounds good."
Unbelievable. And,
yeah. I mean, it was a great job, except for the fact that because I was just the lighting technician, it's not a very highly valued job. Occasionally when things would go very, very badly with the bands, it would be my job to go clean up the green room.
Do you find that those kinds of jobs have an effect on you as your understanding of the work you do later in life? I mean, I had a bunch of really crummy jobs for years, and I was a security guard, and I was a dishwasher, and I was a pipe dipper. And I...
What? That's amazing.
It was a high school job. It was a high school summer job. We dipped these 200-pound lead pipes in PVC coating, which is a carcinogenic, in a non-union factory with the windows rolled up so that the toxic fumes wouldn't get out to the public, so there wouldn't be any complaints to the EPA, I guess. And so, yeah, it was pretty grim. And I'm not big, and I'm... I wasn't strong at the time, so it was a gruesome job. Huh. But, like, I'm so grateful every day that I do my job, and anytime I start to, I mean, that to me, what having on my worst day as a designer, I'm still grateful.
Yeah, that was my immediate thought when you asked the question. It's like, if anything, I'm all of those past jobs made me really thankful that I have a job where my brain is the thing that I'm being hired for, as opposed to like being there. Cause all of my college and high school jobs were about kind of showing up. You know, I was a waitress at a beach bar. I worked at a t-shirt shop. Actually, the t-shirt shop job was when I got into graphic design, because they would come in and customers would come in and they'd say, "Oh, you know, my husband's turning 50 and we need t-shirts for everybody that's going to his party that has his face on it." And it would be my job to go into Corel Draw and like put together the thing and then put together the specification and print them out into the iron-on transfers and iron them onto shirts. That was my first graphic design job.
That's super cool.
Yeah.
I made posters. I was in a terrible band, but I made posters for the band, and that was my intro to it. And then later I was a copywriter, but we kept using Quark to do ads, and I started doing art direction.
Oh, Quark. I miss Quark.
Yeah, it was cool.
Yeah.
It was cool. Although, if you think about it, I mean, everything was all sketchy lines.
Yeah. And everything like, you really didn't know what it looked like.
You really didn't know what
it
looked like.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was all FPO, and then you printed on, you know, and it took 10 minutes and didn't really look like the thing.
Yeah, exactly. Oh man, I didn't learn InDesign until having to do the book layout for this book.
Right, you laid out you did your own illustrating for the book.
Mm-hmm.
And you did your own design of the book. You must have worked with an editor though.
I did. Yeah, Nicole Fenton. And she's wonderful. She changed my whole outlook on writing, and she made this book so much better than I ever thought it could have been.
She made sense of your mess.
She really did. And I mean, talk about relieving anxiety. The first couple times we met, I was just like, "Oh my God, am I really going to do this?" You know, and she was such a great coach.
Cool. Who else did you work with? Did someone do the ebook for you, or did you do that as well?
No, I did that as well.
And survived.
I did. Yeah. Yeah. The ebook was, I thought that indexing would be the most difficult part, which I also took on myself, but I found that to be really enjoyable, to be honest. But the ebook publishing, that was not enjoyable. That was like, lock yourself in your apartment for 3 days and like, just your eyes are blaring. And it's basically like you've gone back in time and you're making a website for like, you know, 1998 or something. Cause it's HTML, but really deprecated HTML. It's weird. I do not appreciate the ebook process. I hope that somebody fixes that real soon.
I've thrown a lot of smart people at it with nobody really saw. I mean, we were in a book apart, we work with wonderful people, but I don't think anybody solved that mess. I think it's just a big mess. Like HTML mail is a big mess.
Yeah.
Big 90s HTML. And no one seems to care. No one seems to want to fix it.
Yeah, I'm fairly happy with how mine came out, but there's still things about it that I'm just like, why? Why is that like that? But what are you going to do?
How did you pick the type?
Well, I mean, Helvetica. So, like, because Helvetica, I think, is the answer, I guess. Oh, the internal type. It's Garamond. I'm a fan of Garamond in general. I've always thought it to be a really beautiful typeface.
People believe in it. People believe what they read that's said in Garamond.
And I think that it's an incredibly readable typeface as well. I did have a battle with myself during typesetting about whether or not to justify the type, because it would look so much cleaner and nicer if it was justified. But all of the information that I have about readability says that it's dramatically reduced by justification. So that was a really hard choice for me as a graphic designer. I was like, man, this looks so tight and tidy when it was all justified. But I'm really happy that I decided to leave it ragged, because
the rag was the right choice from a design point of view, because, and from a brand point of view, because the brand of this, the feeling of this is that it's approachable, that it's simple, that it's kind of a workshop, that it's a worksheet, right? Again, you had diagram your reality. You had the diagram we were talking about earlier, words we say, words we don't say. All that stuff comes across as down to earth, easy to understand, graspable. Why wouldn't you do it? It comes across as common sense, right?
A
ragged right also almost conveys that you typeset this yourself, that this is sort of a, not homespun, but almost like you're a teacher who prepared materials. In a subtle way, the design reinforces that.
Well, I wish I had come to that determination before I laid out the whole book with justified type. But I looked at it and I had it printed on CreateSpace and everything. I had a prototype, and it was one of the things that I argued with myself about quite a bit. I'm like, oh, I know it shouldn't be like this, but I like it so much. It's so pretty. So I'm glad it came around.
Now that you have this book out of the way, are you doing any more writing, or are you just done with writing for a while?
No, I've been bit by the bug. I'm totally bit.
So what are you doing?
I am starting a new project that is a book called How to Make Time.
Wow.
And, yeah, it's a broad subject. But the reason is because I was really worried when I wrote a book about information architecture. I was under this preconception that people didn't believe in information architecture. And I found out through getting feedback on the book that it's not necessarily that people don't care about it. It's that they don't feel like they have time for it. And that, like, critical thinking has been something that's sort of been left off of the list of priorities and ways that we spend our time. So I really started to get kind of obsessed with this, writing a second book as sort of an objection handler to the first one. And if people's time is the material that they're lacking in order to do the critical thinking about language and structure, then why don't I teach them how to make time? Because that's something that I've always been fairly good at doing.
And you know what? It's not going to be just for designers who need to do information architecture. It's going to be for anybody in this world right now. It's going to be for every parent who doesn't have enough time.
Yeah.
Right. To take care of themselves and take care of their kids, have a life. Mm-hmm. It's all too much. And work. People are constantly, choosing between work and life and all that stuff. So anything that helps with that, and it's a great title, How to Make Time. You know, I don't just see you folding balloons in joints. I see you folding balloons in Carnegie Hall. No, I do. I see How to Make Time not just as a cult book, not just as a trade book, but that could be a, that could be like a Jason Fried book, right? Or a Gary Vaynerchuk book, a book that breaks through and to a more mass audience, which wouldn't be so bad.
I'm definitely I'm writing it for the people that I know are fans of my writing already, because most of them have shown interest in this topic. So last year, I did a year-long series with The Pastry Box where I wrote about time, and I did a six-piece series. And the reception that I got to those pieces was just so wonderful. I mean, people just, really making strides to make their life better through looking at time as this material that you can wield like a tool. And so I really hope just to write it for them. But I think it's similar to, I wrote the first book for my students, and, I had 20 students that I was writing for, and it turned out to be a book that was really resonant with a whole community. So
you can write a book just for you, or just for what, for your dead parent, or who knows what, it doesn't really matter. Dickens used to laugh and pry at his own stuff, right? Mm-hmm. So that's okay. At abbydia.com, you publish a lot of thought pieces, articles.
Yeah. I love writing. I didn't know that I loved writing until, the last, I would say 10 years, and information architecture and being part of the IA community. And actually you brought up Peter Morville, earlier in the conversation. He was one of the people that really spurred me to start writing because, I met Peter at an event that I was helping to run the IA summit, back in 2010. And he was one of the first people in the community that really made me feel like my thoughts had value and that everything hadn't already been written. Because I think it's really easy when you're new to a community, coming into something that's already kind of going and has thought leaders. And it's easy to believe that everybody has it all figured out and that you're just like catching up. But in reality, there's things that might be going on in your work or in your life or the way that you're personally thinking about it that could be this new lens on something. And Peter was one of the first people that really like made me stop and think like, yeah, I have stuff to say. So
absolutely.
You know, and starting Abby the IA, my blog, which was, .wordpress for a while. And last year or the year before last, as I was getting ready to publish, I finally moved it over to my own domain and started to really take it seriously.
That's great. And everyone listening to this should write. Everyone listening to this should blog, even if you have 5 readers at first.
Absolutely.
It doesn't really matter. It's not a popularity game. It's not a numbers game. Some of the most influential writers of our time, like you have like 10 followers on Twitter, right? but the right 10 people.
Yeah. No, and writing is, I mean, it's a way of getting out what's inside of you. I mean,
knowing what you
who
think.
Doesn't, like you don't know what you think until you try to write it down. And then you realize, oh my gosh, I don't actually know anything about this topic, or I know a whole lot about this topic.
Right.
And those moments are really valuable.
Absolutely. Talk about IA Summit, please.
So the IA Summit is an event that has been going on for well over a decade now. So I think in the introduction, you had said that I was one of the founders of it, but that's actually not true.
I'm sorry.
Oh, that's okay. I just wanted to make sure for the actual founders out there that they hear me.
I thought you were.
No, World IA Day is one of the things that I've founded. But the IA Summit is a national event that takes place every year in a different location in North America. It's happening in Atlanta this year in May. It's a great group of folks. I mean, it's people describe it as somewhere between like a summer camp and a family reunion in terms of tone. So it's very casual, but it also tends to draw the best thinkers in our industry to be premiering pieces of their work. So whether that's a talk or a poster or even the latest karaoke rendition that they have of a pop song, which happens every year as well. So it's a great event. I would highly recommend it for anybody who's IA interested.
It sounds kind of like South by Southwest in the old days.
Yeah.
Like when there was a small group of digital people going every year and it was really about just seeing each other and reconnecting and all that.
Yeah, no, exactly. I mean, a lot of people, myself included, it's the only conference that I pay to attend every year.
Well, I don't know if I approve of that.
I just, you know, it's especially as an independent consultant, it's really difficult to make the value statement of attending conferences. And the IA Summit is consistently on my list of like, yep, I will place the budget in that direction every year.
Are you speaking there?
This year I'm not. I'm curating poster night, which is sort of like the IA science fair, I guess. It's everybody gets a little presentation space to put up their poster or interactive display, and then the attendees walk around and talk to all of the presenters. So it's a really fun event.
Cool. Super cool. I want to thank you for your time today and wish you luck. Now, the book is called How to Make Sense of Any Mess. And in the show notes, we'll include the URLs, but you can just go to www.howtomakesenseofanymess.com, which lists a table of contents, some stuff about the book, and links to an Amazon page where you can buy it. Your teacher at SVA, a member of IA Institute. You tweet at abby_the_IA and blog at abbydia.com. Tell us real quickly what's next.
World IA Day 2016. We are in the final month of getting prepared for that. So it is a one-day annual celebration that is all over the world. We have 68 locations in 34 countries across six continents. So I guess my message for getting ready for that is if anybody is an IA enthusiast in Antarctica, please get in touch because I'd love to add that final continent to our list for 2017. But yeah, worldiaday.org. It's going to be huge. We expect somewhere around 10,000 attendees to be participating this year.
And what date is that?
It's February the 20th.
Okay. And is it free?
It is free in many locations. Yeah. So it's all up to the local organizers to determine the cost ratio of putting on the event. But it's all accessible ticket levels, if not free.
And is it online?
There are a lot of live streaming locations, so that's something that we're using YouTube as our live streaming partner this year. So there'll be on the day of lots of Twitter and Facebook action present, like pointing to the presentations that'll be going live.
How, and you run this every year?
Yeah. Dan Klein and I came up with the idea 5 years ago, and we ran our first event in 2012 in 14 cities, and we got about 1,500 attendees, and then it's just ramped up from there. And now we're at 68 locations, which is just a crazy number. I mean, I used to be able to name them all, and now I can't even attempt to try.
Oh, that's great. That's great.
Yeah, and it's all different languages and different cultures. And the thing that I really like about it is that it gives people in their local community an opportunity to stand up and say that they want to contribute at a local level to the IA community and say, like, right, I think this is important. I think other people in my community should understand it better. So I'm going to put the heart and soul into creating an event for my local community. And some of them are huge produced events. I mean, our Boston location this year has, you know, they have a professional AV team and a really nice theater that they've rented, and it's going to be for, you know, 250 people. But we have other locations that are in a coffee shop where they're going to be live streaming talks from other countries. So it sort of runs the spectrum in terms of based on how big the community is and what the interest level is. What they produce.
That is great. I wish you a lot of luck with that. And
thank you.
I'll be watching it and hope to have you back on the show sometime soon.
I would love it. Thank you so much, Jeffrey.
Thanks, Abby. Bye-bye.
Right. Bye.